It's out of control. I guess, okay, whatever, that's fine. Yeah, we just have to make do, I think. Yeah, it's good enough. Yeah. We had this retreat center for, what is it, 7 years now? Still nobody knows how to operate the lights. That's letting go, relaxing. It's good, isn't it? I think it's quite good, actually. Listen, you can see that in a negative way and a positive way. Okay, so we come to this evening's questions. So we'll see what is here. Wow, there's quite a lot of questions today. So we'll see how we go. Okay, number one, does coffee affect the meditation? How can I regulate the breath rhythm while doing meditation? Sometimes I feel like I'm short of breath. Okay, does coffee affect the meditation? It really depends. You have to find out for yourself. Everybody is different in this regard. For some people, find coffee quite good. You know, in the morning, you're a bit tired. A bit of coffee can help you. And other times, coffee may make you feel restless and may, you know, agitated or whatever. So it really depends. So you have to kind of test it out for yourself. But sometimes a little bit of stimulants like that can be perfectly okay. It's not a major problem. Right? Coffee is a very minor stimulant, really. I wouldn't worry too much about it. I think coffee is fine. Just sort of check it out for yourself and see what happens. How can I regulate the breath rhythm while doing meditation? Please don't regulate the breath rhythm. If you regulate the breath rhythm, you are on the wrong path already. So just allow it to be. If you feel short of breath, as you say here, it may be that you are regulating the breath already, right? Maybe you're already controlling the breath. Maybe that is the problem. Maybe you need to deregulate the breath rather than regulate it. Have you considered that? So try to deregulate rather than regulate, and you may actually be on the right track. Often the problem is that our control of things is often very subtle. We have this subtle sense of involvement with things. The mind is still getting involved with the body, trying to control things, trying to control our mind and all these kind of things. So what we want to do is try to withdraw from that. Right? So very often, the reason why we regulate the breath rather than allow the breath to be is that we have not yet established enough mindfulness. If you find yourself being short of breath, then try just to let go of the breath a little bit. Get back to the body, feel what the body feels like. If you find that you are regulating things, it often means the body also can then perhaps feel a little bit tense or something like that. Usually, the working of the mind, the will, the choice, the doing of the mind usually is felt physically in the body. So see if you can feel it in the body and then abandon that, release that first of all, then go back to the breath and see if it's any better. It may be the feeling you're short of breath may just be a perception that you have. One of the things that happen in meditation, we get all kinds of perceptions coming up, all kinds of weird things. People think they are dying, they think they are expanding, they think they are contracting, they think they are floating in the air. You think you're flying, you know, through the room, but actually you're not flying at all. You're sitting there quite nicely. I forget about that. I'm not even going to talk about that. But there's all kinds of perceptions. All these perceptions are very, very common when you do meditation practice. And most of them are no problem whatsoever. So just allow yourself to be short of breath. If it feels uncomfortable and you're short of breath, it probably means you are doing something with it. If it feels not uncomfortable, you're just short of breath, then probably it's okay. You can allow it to be. So you have to investigate a little bit, right? This is kind of one of the things about the Buddhist path. Investigate, see if you can figure out what's going on, and then you will be on the right track. So those are a couple of options for you. So see how you go with that. And if it doesn't work, you can... you probably can't complain, actually. That's really good news, isn't it? No complaining is possible. Okay, anyway. Dear Ajahn, what is the basic practice to do in day-to-day life to have good meditation practice? How can we do this basic thing in day-to-day life? What is the basic practice to have a good meditation practice? Okay, the basic practice is that... Bianca, while you're there... Venerable Bado and myself, we will be coming for the meal tomorrow. Yes, we'll be. Okay. Yeah. So the basic practice in for a Buddhist is not actually meditation practice at all. The basic practice is the practice of morality, of virtue, of doing the right thing, or having a good heart. This is the basic practice. And this is far more important than any meditation you do. And you will find, if you keep that practice up, and you not only keep it up, remember that in Buddhism, it's not just about keeping the five precepts, right? Of course, we have to keep the five precepts. That's the minimum standard. But it's about doing all the good things, doing all the right things, being kind to others, saying kind words that go to the heart, etc., etc. And when you build that up, all of these things over a long period of time, after a while, it changes you, your attitude changes. And when you sit down and you close your eyes, you just feel good inside because you know that you're living a good life. And this is the basic practice. And this is the basic practice that makes meditation possible. And then when you come back next year, right? Are you going to come back next year? Maybe, maybe not. We'll see what happens. But it's not any probably advisable to make any promises. But anyway, let's say you come back next year. I would recommend that. You can come to, you know, some other retreat. Doesn't have to be me, whoever it is. And then you check yourself out and you see, is my mindfulness improving? Is my shortness of breath less bad than last year? I had shortness of breath, right? This year, no shortness of breath. So something has happened. You find yourself able to stay with the breath. You feel good inside of yourself. And you know that something has happened in the meantime. That is how you know that you're on the right path. You know you're doing the right practice. Because when you sit down, when you go on retreat, something has changed. Right? So it's a gradual movement. And we can always do things to improve ourselves, improve our lives, to do things better. If you are going to have a daily meditation practice, you don't have to. If you don't want to meditate at all, it's fine. You know, sometimes you get fed up with meditation. It isn't getting you anywhere. So leave it aside for a while. Don't do anything for a while. It doesn't matter. It's okay. Much more important that you keep your, you're doing the right thing in life. That's far more important. But if you are going to have a daily meditation practice, make sure it is something that supports your morality, supports your integrity, supports your ability to be kind to people, to be patient with people. One of the most difficult things is to be patient with people who say stupid things to us, right? But as I say, it's their problem. It's got nothing to do with me. If they say stupid things, it's none of my business. You know, they just do that. It's their upbringing or their background or whatever that causes them to say stupid things. Okay, well, that's just the way it is. It's fine. And when you look at these things in the right way, you can let go of such things so easily. It doesn't bother you anymore. You know it's got nothing to do with you. It's all to do with the other person. In this way, you start to change your attitude, you change your whole way of looking at life, how you look at other people. You start to see people as prisoners of their bad qualities. They are prisoners, right? If somebody is a prisoner of their bad qualities, are you going to be upset with them? Or are you going to forgive them? You will forgive them because you understand that they are probably hurting far more than you are because of whatever bad qualities they have. And in this way, you're moving, changing. Your whole outlook is changing. It's incredibly simple, but incredibly powerful. And one of the reasons why this is possible from a Buddhist point of view is all this idea of no self, right? Non-self. We are the product of our conditioning. Because you are the product of the conditioning, you're also a prisoner of that conditioning. It's exactly the same idea. So if you're going to meditate, make sure you meditate to support this. So do a bit of meditation practice where you feel peaceful and calm. You go out into the world, it's easier for you to deal with the people around you. Do some metta meditation, right? It's wonderful to be on a retreat like this. Remember, when you are here, you have all this wonderful support around you. People who practice the five precepts, people who spend their whole life doing good things. Right, anybody who comes on a meditation retreat like this, guarantee that they are serious. They have a serious spiritual aspect in their life. Isn't that a wonderful thing? Isn't that something worthy of celebrating? Right? We don't need any balloons, but we can celebrate inside, right? Happy about these things. And when we rejoice in these qualities, then you actually create a very strong community, a strong Buddhist community. And you feel the goodness around you. When you focus on that, you can feel it. And it supports you in your meditation. Everything goes better as a consequence. In my experience, people who are Buddhists tend to be very, very good people. What's the point of calling yourself a Buddhist if you're not going to do what is right in this world? There's no point. You become a Buddhist in name only. And most people who come on a retreat, they are precisely not Buddhists in name only. So try some of these things and then see how things go. And if it doesn't work, then you can come back next year and you can complain and say, all this stuff you're telling us doesn't work. What should I do next? Okay. Anyway, so next question. Is it true that the Buddha said that when there are at least 4 bhikkhus or bhikkhunis born in a country that are living in that country, then the Dhamma is established in that place? If that is true, then Australia, being multicultural, can look forward to a rainbow sangha, and already has a rainbow sangha. Yes, indeed. I'm not sure if the Buddha actually said that. The saying is that once you perform an ordination in a country, that's when Buddhism is considered established there, right? To perform an ordination ceremony, you have to have at least 5 bhikkhus or 5 bhikkhunis. Bhikkhus are monks, bhikkhunis are nuns. So you have to have 5 to be able to do that. So that's usually when it's considered established in that country. And I think it is one of the great strengths of the, not only the Sangha here, but also the lay Buddhist in Perth, that it is so multicultural and ethnically diverse. I think that is one of the wonderful things about this Buddhist society, that we can kind of work together like that. I think that's great. If we can't work together as Buddhists, then it tells us something about our Buddhist ideas. We should be able to do that, and I think we do that really well. And I think that's great. When you look around the world, one of the things that I feel is unfortunate is that in the vast majority of places, every ethnic group, they have their own ethnic temple, right? The Sri Lankans will have the Sri Lankan temple, the Thais have the Thai temple, the Chinese have the Chinese temple, the Western-born people, they have the Vipassana centers, right? And that's how it goes. But should it really be like that? The Dhamma is the same for all of us. So we should be able to unite. We should be able to work together. And then it becomes very powerful. And we become a good example for the rest of the world, how we should be able to work together. We don't need to separate across these ethnic lines. It's madness. We should be able to work together. That's a wonderful thing that is. So yes, so hopefully the Sangha also can become more more diverse. That would be great as well. We're already quite multicultural, but maybe that can be even improved even further. So we'll see how things go. Okay. Next one. Okay, this is a very short question. It has exactly 5 words in it, a question mark at the end. Can you enjoy it? Every moment. I assume it's not a personal question. It's not directed to me, right? It's a general question, presumably. So, can you enjoy every moment? And the answer is no. It's impossible, right? It reminds me, even if you are the Buddha, you have to sometimes have physical pain, physical problems. So the Buddha, I don't think he probably, it would be wrong to say that he suffered, but he says towards the end of his life, he says that only when I go into the animitta samadhi, the signless samadhi, do I feel comfort in the body. Right? So that's what happens when you get old. The body starts to deteriorate, it falls apart, and you have pains and problems as a consequence. The Buddha is no different. He also has a human body, just like everybody else. So even for him, he has to go into a state of samadhi to feel comfort in the body. So there is some suffering there, even for the Buddha. It's not mental suffering. He doesn't compound the physical suffering by complaining about it in his mind. His mind is equanimous. His mind is balanced. He's able to deal with it, right? Most of us, we can't deal with these things, but he could. And this is really the difference between the arahant and the ordinary person. So the arahant can deal with it, but still there is physical suffering there. So can you be happy in every moment, or can you enjoy every moment? No, while you are in meditation, deep meditation, yes. But as soon as you come back out again, of course, some of the problems will re-arise. But what you can reduce the problems, right? And this is what's happening on the path. What we forget is that the vast majority of problems are mind-created. It's all the craving, it's all the negativity, all the complaining that we have in the mind. That is the main problem. That is like 99.9% of the problem. If you take away that, then the physical suffering you have is just tiny in comparison to the mental suffering here. It's hard to see that, right? It's very difficult to see that because we've never really been there before. We don't really know what it's like to have no craving, no delusion. Because we don't know what it is, we have to kind of gradually extract ourselves from that, get a perspective on things, and gradually start to see that this is true. And as you, the more deeply you go into meditation, the more clear it becomes that this is the case. When the mind is perfectly happy, the body disappears. Then you start to understand why this is the case and how this works. Okay. So, when I start meditation, it seems to be very calm and clear about mindfulness. When I start breath meditation within a few minutes, the mind is all over. Please explain how to overcome this. Okay, so what is probably happening there is that you don't really want to be with the breath, right? So because you don't want to be with the breath, the mind starts rebelling. And the mind rebels, it is all over the place. This is probably what's going on here. So it basically what it means is that you have to make the breath more attractive. You have to enjoy the breath. Part of the problem is probably that your mindfulness is not quite as sharp and clear as you think it is. Maybe it is a bit dull, maybe it isn't as sharp as you think it is. And one way of overcoming that is to make the breath attractive. The way to make the breath attractive is to do perhaps a little bit of metta meditation, right? Just remember the good qualities of the people around you. Spread those qualities out to everyone in the world. Have a sense of metta together with the breath. See your breath as this old friend, as I was just saying now during the meditation. Your breath is this wonderful friend, right? He's been with you throughout your life's journey, however old you are. Every day, every moment, your breath supports you. You wouldn't last long without breathing, right? So your breath is like a friend. So you kind of, you make a being out of the breath. It's called anthropomorphization. You make it into a human being. And then you thank the breath. You have a sense of gratitude for always being there for you, always being part of, with you. It's a bit, little bit artificial, of course, but it's okay. Things don't have to, you know, that's perfectly okay. So the breath is your friend. And when you do that, you feel a sense of warmth, you feel a sense of ease. You want to be with a friend. A good friend is somebody you want to be with. Another way is to develop a sense of metta apart from the breath, as I was just saying before. And then when you have a good warm feeling inside, then you can move on to the breath afterwards. The point here is the attitude. The attitude is so important. When the attitude is right, things tend to work out. I'll talk more about that tomorrow, because this is one of the foundations of the whole spiritual path in Buddhism, is to get this attitude right. It has all to do with sila, morality, our character as human beings. So that is my guess for why this is happening. So don't go to the breath so quickly. Stay more calm and peaceful. Bring up some of those positive perceptions. And then try gently to go to the breath. If you find that your mind is all over the place again, go back. Don't stay with it. Don't try to force it, because it will just backfire. Allow it to happen quite as naturally as it can. Okay, dear Ajahn, what is the right way to do walking meditation? Also, sometimes when I watch my breath for a while, I seem to end up controlling the breath. How to avoid controlling the breath? Many thanks. Okay, so walking meditation, right way. There's many things you can do during walking meditation. One thing, the first thing is just to set aside a suitable path, right? 20 steps, 30 steps, something like that, which is in a nice place, wherever that might be. And usually you just walk back and forth on that path. And I recommend when you do walking meditation to walk at a natural speed. Sometimes people recommend walking very slowly, but I think natural is better, because natural, well, it depends on your abilities in meditation, depends on many things, but I think for most people, natural is better, because natural speed means no control, right? Or at least less control. So you just walk naturally. It means you feel more at ease, you feel more good about things. And what you should do when you walk really depends on your state of mind. So you have to know yourself. You've just been sitting down for an hour and a half, half an hour or an hour or whatever it is. And then you walk. You have to know what is right for me to do now. For example, if you have been sitting down and you feel a bit tense for some reason, right? You haven't been able to relax or whatever it is. If that is the case, I would recommend you to do absolutely nothing when you do walking meditation. Just walk back and forth and just enjoy, right? I'm here at Jhana Grove. Wow, it's so peaceful here. You know, maybe you see a kangaroo over there, you see a bird or whatever. Just walk back and forth and enjoy. Don't even have to walk back and forth. Just walk a bit in nature. That's good enough as well. If you feel the need to just relax and take it easy a little bit. Sometimes we get tense even though we don't really want to, because we are so used to controlling here, and it's actually very difficult to let go of all that controlling here. So this is one way. Just don't do anything at all. There's a very famous Burmese meditation teacher who teaches all over the world. He was here a couple of years ago, and he said exactly that. And I thought, yeah, that makes sense. Just walk back and forth. Just enjoy the peace, right? If you're enjoying the peace, your mind is leaning, inclining in the right direction, already doing the right thing here. This is one possibility. This may be the best technique for most people to use. Maybe that's the best one, depending on the circumstances. If by some chance your meditation is going really, really well, you're sitting and you just feel that, you know, everything is going fantastically well, you're kind of feeling happiness and joy in the meditation, but after a while you kind of come out naturally, but you want to continue the focused meditation instead of focusing on the breath, focusing on something else, you can focus on your feet as you walk back and forth. And it's possible to actually get quite profound samadhi just by walking back and forth like that. Ajahn Brahm is the example of a person who gets good samadhi by just doing walking meditation. And he said in his early days when he was a young monk at Wat Nanachat in Thailand, this is the International Forest Monastery in Thailand, and they had just laid the concrete, right? The concrete was laid for the new hall. This was back in the 1970s. How long is that? 40 years ago or something like that. And just laid the concrete. And the concrete was laid by the local villagers, right? And those local villagers had no idea about how to lay concrete. So the concrete, when it was finished, was kind of all over the place, right? Really bumpy and really supposed to be flat, right? But it was really bad. So they would sit there. It was very uncomfortable to sit on, but they would also do walking meditation on this concrete floor here. And Ajahn Brahm says he would just walk back and forth. And because of his samadhi is so powerful, he said that all of these colors, all of these shapes, all of these things would come out of the concrete. Right? He would see like this, whoa, these amazing things coming out of the concrete, colors, shapes, all these kind of things. And what is happening there? This is again, perception is playing with you, because the mind is becoming focused, the mind is becoming powerful. Things start to arise that you normally cannot see here. So he said that concrete was the most beautiful thing in the world. Right? Wow, all this wonderful concrete. And because of that, since then, we have always had to dissuade Ajahn Brahm from laying concrete everywhere in our monastery. Please, no more concrete roads. And we have to have more concrete in the monastery. Not enough concrete yet. No, please, enough of this concrete. I'm exaggerating, but something like that, right? And this is the thing. So it is all about walking meditation too can be quite powerful. That's really the point here. Another thing that you can do in walking meditation is to contemplate things. When you want to contemplate something, then often it is easier if you have some movement in the body. Natural movement in the body also needs to a fairly natural movement in the mind. And sometimes if you find that you're not becoming peaceful, contemplation can be very powerful. You contemplate things like impermanence, right? And this happened here just a few weeks ago. We're supposed to have this retreat. That was on 2 weeks ago or something. Supposed to have the retreat with Bhante Gunaratana, you know, the very famous a meditation teacher who lives in Virginia in the United States. And he was 88 years old or something now. He was supposed to come here, very beloved by so many people around the world. And he was supposed to come. But of course, when you are 88 years of age, then, you know, health issues tend to become a bit shaky, right? A bit dodgy. And so we should have really have anticipated that, you know, he might not come. Actually, probably we did. We just invited him anyway. And then people are disappointed, right? Oh, he can't come. It would be nice to see him. And then you realize, when he doesn't come, you realize probably we will never see him again in Perth. Maybe we will, but most likely we won't. And that is, when that sinks in, it leads to this perception of impermanence, how unreliable things really are in this world, right? How suddenly things change, how you can't really control things anymore. Things are, by their very nature, incredibly unreliable. But of course, we think that things have gone wrong. Things went wrong. We weren't able to control it. Of course you can't control it. And then we get upset with people because things don't go according to our plans or whatever. But that is a completely un-Buddhist attitude. Things are inherently uncontrollable. And this idea of perception of impermanence can then lead you to let go of things. And when you let go of things, that is when peace and calm comes into you. And this is the whole purpose of any kind of wisdom reflection that you do. The whole purpose of these wisdom reflections, thinking about impermanence, thinking about suffering, thinking about non-self, contemplating death perhaps. I know many people don't like that, but I think it's great to contemplate death. It's a wonderful thing. It helps you to let go. It makes you feel peaceful. It makes you feel happy. If it makes you feel happy, it must be good. So check it out. If you feel uncomfortable about it, don't do it. But if you feel comfortable about death contemplation, it's great stuff. And then, when you do that, you find that you let go because you understand that you can't hold on to these things. So when you let go, it means that craving subsides, ill will subsides, attachment subsides. When all these things subside, all these things which lead to activity, which lead to looking into the future, thinking about the past, when all of those things subside, you feel peaceful. So the whole purpose of this, and this is what you can call insight contemplation if you like, the whole purpose of this kind of wisdom is called developing sanya in the sutta. Sanya means developing perceptions. And when you develop those in the right way, you let go, you feel peaceful. So often contemplation, together with watching the breath, together with doing all these other things, together it becomes very, very powerful. These are the things you can try. You can also do metta when you walk back and forth, right? May all these beings out there in the bush, all the people to the north, may they be happy and well. There are so many good people in the world. Sometimes we forget that. We watch the news on TV and you think everybody is bad. But the news on TV is not reality. That's just a tiny part of the world's population. You don't see reality there. Reality is what you see here, right? With people around you. This is the reality. And there's a lot of goodness and kindness in the world. So wish people well, wherever they are. And also those people who are suffering. This you can do too while you do walking meditation. So this is a whole topic in itself, right? Walking meditation. You can do so many different things. But what you should do depends on you. You have to look inside of yourself. And then you know what is the right thing for you to do. Sometimes the right thing to do is just go back to your room and lie down, right? And sometimes just have a cup of tea, lie down, do nothing. Sometimes that is right. So again, figure it out for yourself. Only you can really know that. How to avoid controlling the breath? Again, you have to just... one of the reasons why you control it is because you feel that the breath is slipping away from you, right? You're not really mindful enough. It's going to slip away, so you want to hold it back. So this is one of the points. Don't be afraid of allowing the breath to go. Allow the breath to go. And then wait for it to come back all by itself. This is how you avoid controlling it. So just allow it to go. When you have your attention on the breath, it should be feather light attention. It's like you're resting your attention on the breath. Very, very light. Right? Very, just really, really light. So light that you feel it can disappear at any time. And that's okay. If it disappears at any time, that's fine. You wait, it comes back again. And it goes back and forth like that. Or what you can do if you feel that it becomes very difficult, just abandon the breath altogether. Go back to a prior stage. Do something else instead. Do a bit of metta meditation. Do these other things that makes the breath more attractive. When the breath is attractive, you will have a natural attraction and you will use less force as you watch it. Okay. Dear Ajahn Ramali, question number one. Do you think sila, character, is the same as integrity? Is there a Pali word for integrity? Is sila, character, the same as integrity? I think it is probably, there is some degree of similarity there. Integrity, to me, is a bit like you are the same person in different situations, right? You don't treat some people one way, other people the other way. You treat everybody in roughly the same way. So integrity, I think, has more to do with consistency, perhaps, than it has to do with... But also, we talk about moral integrity, so it means that you have moral integrity, you have integrity, or you have morality across the board, wherever you go, whoever you're dealing with. So there is certainly a large overlap there between integrity and morality. So I would say, yes, is there such a word as integrity in Pali? Well, there is something in the Pali canon called the Sangaha Vatuni. Vatuni, the basis for Sangaha. Sangaha means collecting together. And it means if you want to have lots of friends, right? Then this is what you do. You have this basis for making lots of friends. If you want to have lots of people to kind of to follow you around and to kind of be your disciples or whatever, if you want to have lots of disciples, then this is how you do that. You have this Sangaha Vatuni. It means the basis for collecting people around you. And one of these bases is to treat people the same. You treat everybody the same. You don't have favorites. This is my favorite. I will be nice to you. I don't like this person. Okay. So this is, you know, you treat everybody roughly the same. You don't have favorites that you give special preference to. And this is one of these. And it's called, the Pali word for that is something like sammanatta or something like that. It means basically equality. And that is perhaps the closest to come to this word integrity in English. Sammanatta or something like that. I can't remember exactly how it is spelled in Pali. Sammanattata. Anyway, if you are very interested in that word, then please see me later on and I shall furnish you with the required Pali word. Okay, second question here. Okay, I better put my glasses on. It's a bit blurry here. How do you balance ideas like speaking up, fighting or striving to end poverty, injustice, inequality, with the concepts of acceptance and letting go? What brings peace to the heart is often to let things be, but is this apathy? Thank you. I think speaking up and I think fighting is probably not so such a good word. If you're fighting, then there's probably maybe a little bit too much antagonism, perhaps too much ill will involved in that. Speaking up, striving to end poverty, these things are all good, but remember that what really matters on the Buddhist path, the things that are going to be of value to you, is the quality of your heart, right? This is what matters. What matters more than speaking up is, why are you speaking up? Are you doing it because of compassion? Are you doing it because of loving kindness? Are you doing it because you want to be of help to other people? Or are you doing it because you're angry with the oppressors? These are very different things, right? So why are you speaking up? Motivation is the crucial things that make something positive for your character or something negative for your character. So this is a lot of people in the world, they feed on anger, the self-righteous anger. These people are bad, I want to be angry with them. But anger, in my experience, doesn't solve any problems, neither for the person who is angry, nor for the things that you are trying to sort out. Much better to do things out of kindness and compassion, if at all possible. So that is the right way, because when you do things out of kindness and compassion, you are safeguarding your own virtue, your own kindness. If you do things out of anger, then when you come sit down to meditate, your mind will be all over the place and very difficult to meditate. And in the long run, you will find that you are also, by building up these bad qualities inside of you, you will actually make meditation more difficult also in the long run. So be very careful about these things. And if you find that you're getting angry about something, then it is time to withdraw a little bit and not be so involved anymore. Otherwise, you just destroy your own practice. If you find that you are able to be compassionate all the time and just focus on the victims and not worry about the perpetrators or whatever it is, then great. Best way of dealing with these issues is, as I was saying before, to remember that in the end, everyone is a victim. Right? Everyone is a victim. Why is somebody a perpetrator of a crime or something bad? Whatever that badness might be. Why is that? And it's almost always out of ignorance, out of lack of understanding that they're creating enormous suffering for themselves and also for the victims of their crimes. So they too are victims in a very real sense. They will have to bear the results of their actions, right? They are deluded. They don't understand that they're doing something crazy. How can you feel towards somebody who doesn't understand? Can you be angry with them? You have to feel compassion for them, right? They don't understand. If there's some suicide bomber goes off and kills 50 people, it's madness. It's absolute madness. You have to feel compassion for this incredible stupidity of a person who does something like that. Of course, you also have compassion for the victims. You have compassion for both sides. And in this way, if you can do that, then of course, then your standing up for poverty or inequality or injustice, it becomes incredibly powerful because you understand both sides of the equation, so to speak, and then it becomes much easier to help. If people feel that you are motivated by kindness, they are far more likely to listen to you. If you are motivated by anger and people feel that straight away, they become defensive, they don't want to listen to you anymore. I don't believe in anger. I think anger is a bad thing. People talk about being angry because they're activists, and they say anger gives me energy. Anger gives you short-term energy, long-term loss of energy. It's only short-term that it gives you energy. In the long run, it destroys it. And if you understand that, then you change your attitude to these things. So you have to know for yourself what works, right? And then the most important thing in our lives is not so much how we deal with the big issues in the world. The big issues in the world are kind of distant from us. What is more important is how we deal with people in the immediate environment, right? How are we dealing with each other right now? How am I dealing with the monks in the monastery? How am I dealing with my family, right, when I call up my family? These are actually things that probably are far more important than the big issues in the world, because it has more impact on us. If I treat my parents well, I will feel good about myself. If I treat my own parents badly, I will feel bad. They're very close to me. And the impact that has on my mind is very, very powerful compared to the impact on whether I help somebody in poverty, which I have no idea about. So the people around us, the immediate surroundings, are usually much more important, they have more impact on our mind than the big questions in the world. This is one way to decide, you know, what kind of morality is most important. So make sure you get that right at the very least. Treat the people in your environment in the right way. That is the most important thing. Okay. Dear Ajahn Ramali, as soon as I bring attention to my breath, it feels that I control and alter it. Why is that? And what can I do to be more passive and observative? Thank you, Janine. Okay, well, I think I have tried to answer that already. So see if those answers help. And if not, then we can try one more time at some other time. Okay. I have to go a little bit fast, this is not the question. Okay, wow, these are the best questions. Not the question. Thank you, a first-timer, inspirational Dhamma talks in plain English, that made complete sense. Never doubt your teaching. Thank you. I will return to the forest again. Okay, that's good. I'm very glad for that. First-timer who is already happy. That's really always good news. It may not last, I have to warn you. Sometimes you get really inspired in the beginning. You think, wow, it is so wonderful. And after 2 years, you think, ah, all this Buddhism stuff is just all nonsense, doesn't work after all. But sometimes you have to keep yourself inspired, keep yourself going. These teachings are powerful if you persevere over a long, long period of time. That's when they become really, really powerful. Okay. What are the teddy bears for? Yeah, good question. I was a bit surprised myself when I came in here and I saw I had so many co-teachers. And I... 1, 2, 3. They're all meditating really well. I'm pretty impressive teddy bears. The idea with teddy bears is to make a soft atmosphere, right? And softness is so much required in our world. Often we are too hard-hearted. We are too not kind enough to each other. And a teddy bear reminds you of that softness. And I think, as Ram says, that, well, if you feel a bit hard-hearted, you don't feel soft enough, you're always welcome to come up and hug the teddy bear, right? So if you come up and hug the teddy bear, it's a good thing. It means you have that, you have understood the right way to deal with these things. So it's just a way of creating a softer atmosphere in here. And that's always a good thing. It reminds you of what is really important on this path, what works. Okay. Okay, one reason I meditate is that I hope to become more relaxed and cope better with stress, as I have a very stressful job. You mentioned that it is necessary to be relaxed to meditate successfully. Other than being more virtuous, obeying the 8 precepts, how does one relax? Is there any point in trying to meditate if I can't relax? Thank you. Of course you can relax, I think. And I think this is one of the things that you will learn. Of course, on a weekend retreat like this is a fairly short period of time. Sometimes you can come back on a 9-day retreat. You will learn to relax. And I think that even with a stressful job, it is possible to learn to relax even with a stressful job. It is all about perception. How we deal with the job is the most important thing. I have noticed how some people have this incredibly massive amount of energy and have the ability to deal with enormous amounts of stress, whereas other people succumb the tiniest bit of stress and they succumb straight away. Right? There's this enormous difference in people, and the only difference between them is the attitude that they have. Some people have this very positive attitude. They really enjoy their work, right? That is incredibly, almost like a gratitude for being able to go to work. They work these incredible long hours, 100 hours a week or whatever, and still they're full of energy. Still they can work even more. It's just astonishing what some people can do. And I've noticed that those people who have that love for their job, love for their work, these are people who also never get stressed. They can always do more. It's like an endless amount of energy. So try to see if you can really love your work. Try to see the benefit of it. Try to have this positive attitude towards it, right? And as you do that, the amount of stress will decrease because you have a positive feeling about it. This is one way of dealing with that stress. And as you learn to change your attitude towards the people around you, that's another way that reduces the stress. Often people make us feel stressed. So if you have a different attitude towards the people around you, if you start to understand them in a new way, you have more kindness towards them, that also can reduce the stress in your life. But also, remember, sometimes, if you find that you are trapped in a job that you don't like, that is stressful, with people who are difficult, sometimes it's okay to change your job for that reason, right? I had enough of all this. Don't want to stress anymore. This is just too painful. Maybe there is some other job out there. Like what? Like being a monk, right? That's a great job, being a monk. Very stressless. No stress at all. All you do is... you sit in your kuti. Actually, if you are not used to sitting in a small hut in the forest all the time, actually that can be stressful as well, right? Nothing to do. Or, you feel kind of at loose ends. You're kind of used to socializing. There's nobody around. So that, But being a monk is actually, I think it's really wonderful. It's absolutely an amazing invention. I don't know how it happened, but you have to be ready for that as well. But there are different ways of dealing with these things. So remember your priorities in life. What is really important to you? Right? What actually matters? Where are you hoping to go? And for me, the most important thing in the world, the only thing that really matters is to develop myself, to develop my mind, to move myself in the right direction, to feel that I gradually become more kind. I feel that I gradually have less anger, less desires, that I become wiser. That's the only thing that interests me. Everything else is secondary. Who cares about having a career if it doesn't give you a sense of happiness, contentment, fulfillment inside? It's irrelevant, right? When you come to your deathbed and you look back and you had this astonishing career, right? You became the CEO of a large company, or you were an entrepreneur building up some massive business. But if you weren't happy doing that, if it didn't give you something, if it wasn't satisfactory, you're still not going to be happy when you die. That position isn't going to make you happy. What's going to make you happy is if you had a fulfilling life. It's much better to be completely obscure. Nobody knows about you. You have this incredibly humble job. All you do your whole life is cutting people's lawns, right? But if that makes you happy, if that makes you content, who cares about all the other stuff? We are searching for the wrong things. We're looking for happiness in a place where it probably doesn't exist. So we have to turn things around, get our priorities right. When we get the priorities right, then it becomes much easier to solve these kind of dilemmas. For me, the top of the ladder should always be spiritual development. That should be number one. Everything else should be secondary. And this is one of the contemplations I like to do when I sit down to meditate. I tell myself, now, this is what I'm living for. This is when I'm closest to Nibbana in my whole life. This is when I'm closest to what the meaning of life is all about. When I sit down, cross my leg, or I sit on a chair or whatever, this is the time. So if this is the meaning of life, why on earth would I want to think about other things? All those other things you do in life, I do only so I can sit down and cross my legs and meditate. That's why I do them. I do them in such a way that they will help my meditation practice. I do them with integrity, with kindness, doing the right thing, so that when I sit down, I can feel good about that. Right? This is the purpose. And if you really feel that this is the purpose, this is what it's all about, then you don't think about anything else. You don't think about the world tomorrow, what you're going to do when you come back. You don't think about the past, because all of that is irrelevant. That is only pointing to what you're doing now. So get the priorities right. Know what is really important in life. Then things tend to fall into place. The reason why decisions are difficult is because we don't have our priorities right. The Buddha says very beautifully, whenever you make a decision, the decision should always be based on one very simple criterion. And that criterion is that if it is going to make a positive contribution to the good qualities in you, then you should do it. If it is going to make a negative contribution to the good qualities, but a positive contribution to the bad qualities, you should not do it. Anything that leads you in the right direction, that is what you should do. And then you are living the life where you have progress, development of the mind at the top of the hierarchy. That is what really matters in life. So this is how you can sustain monastic life, right? People sometimes wonder, how can you be a monk? I've been a monk now for over 20 years. How can you do that? It's because you have a clarity about what matters in life, what really is important. Then you can do that. So this is what you need to do. If that is very clear in your mind, then why on earth would I not want to be a monk? You have to be crazy to do anything else. When I think about becoming a lay person or getting married or whatever, I think sometimes it's kind of attractive, but in the big picture, it's not something I want to do, because it doesn't help you to develop your mind, and because of that, it's the wrong way. Okay. So, next one. Okay, many feel the point, biggest joy of life is human connection. It is hard to tie in Buddhist monks' lifestyle to human connection. Do you feel they are opposing views? Or these two views can coexist, support each other. The thing is that human connection in itself is kind of neutral, right? What do you mean when you say this is good human connection, right? Family life, having somebody you care for, these kind of things. You don't mean just any kind of human connection. Well, sometimes people want to have any kind of connection because they don't have anything in their life. But really what we're looking for is good human connection. What is the best kind of human connection? It is the Kalyanamitta, right? The good spiritual friend. And the highest kind of human connection is the connection you have with the Buddha, because the Buddha is the highest kind of spiritual friend or Kalyanamitta. He is the one who can give you the teachings as pure as they can be. So this is the kind of human connection you want. Where do you get that kind of human connection the most? Probably by living as a monastic. Right? As a monastic, you have good spiritual friends, people who think roughly, not completely like you, but roughly like you, people who are supporting each other in our practice. It is a place where you're most likely to have a very positive human connection. So what this means is that your need to have a human connection depends on the development of your mind. The more developed your mind is, the more you have inner sense of joy, inner sense of stability, inner sense of compassion and love for the people around you, the less connection you actually need. The reason you want that connection is because you feel that the connection fills you up inside. You feel a lack, and that lack is then reduced through the connection you have with other people. Now, if you can fill that hole inside of you, feel that need inside of you through your meditation practice instead, then that need for the human connection is also diminished. Right? So, and of course, it is a little bit dangerous to rely on human connection for your happiness. If you rely too much on that human connection, it is always unstable, it is always uncertain, always unreliable. You may find the most wonderful person in the world to be your partner, right? Head over heels, you fall in love, wow, it is so beautiful. But then suddenly one day they leave you, or you leave them, or they, whatever happens, this is just life. And then you are left heartbroken, especially, so this can become a very, very big problem. The same thing with your children. You have children you raise in the world, and then your children do stupid things. You are proud of your children until they do bad things, right? And you can't really control them. The children come into this world with their own baggage from the past. They have their own personality. There's only so much you can do to shape their personality. And because of that, you sometimes get very, very disappointed. So this is the danger with the human connection. If you have all of that inside of yourself, if you build that up, so you have a sense of complete fulfillment inside of yourself, you can still have human connection, but it becomes a human connection which is much less needy. There is no real need because you have all the qualities inside of yourself. And this is one of the great things about developing the spiritual path, is that you become much more independent. You become free of that need, right? This is the beautiful thing, this independence. You go back to your little hut in the forest, you sit down. You don't need anybody else in the whole world because you feel you have it all inside of yourself. But this is a gradual movement, gradual. This is why, people like Ajahn Brahm, he can't wait to get away from people because he's much more happy by himself than he is with people. Because he has this absolute, complete fulfillment inside of himself. He goes on retreat for 6 months, and he has 6 months of bliss. Doesn't see anybody for 6 months. Hooray! Nobody to see for 6 months. And this shows you something different. It shows you a potential. It shows you that it's possible to see the world in a radically different way from how we normally see it. This is kind of one of the beautiful things about monasticism, that when it is lived well, when it's practiced in the right way, it gives you like this hope that there is something in the world which is more profound than the ordinary worldly experience. When you see somebody like Ajahn Brahm go on retreat, not talking to a single person for 6 months, living in this tiny hut, he doesn't move from this tiny hut and the walking path for 6 months, right? 6 months not talking to anybody. Most people go completely crazy. He says, whoa, the greatest bliss of my life. Then you understand that there is something more in this world. There is, it is possible to access a very profound kind of happiness and contentment that is normally not immediately accessible to people. He gives us hope. He gives a sense of, wow, there is something in this world that is really worthwhile. So I hope that answers your question. So that is how the monk's lifestyle becomes possible. And we still support each other. We still have Kalamitas, right? So we still, someone like Ajahn Brahm, who is a teacher of so many people around the world, he still does all this good stuff, even though in the end he would probably prefer to sit in his cave and just meditate all the time. Okay, time is going fast, gee. Okay, I've already spent about an hour. I will continue a little bit longer because I can probably squeeze a little bit more energy out of myself. But if you feel tired, you want to go back, please leave at any time. There's no obligation to be here or anything like that. So please leave whenever you feel you've had enough. But I will continue a little bit longer and see what happens. Dear Ajahn, when you say, stay with your body until your body disappears, what does this mean? Do you see aging of the body, structure of the body, or anything else? Okay, so staying with the body until the body, it doesn't really mean disappears. That's a slight exaggeration. What it means is that the body becomes no problem. That's what I really mean by that. So the body, if you feel tension in the body, there's a problem there. Your mind tends to go to that tension and it doesn't make you feel content or happy. So you stay with the body until the body, all the problems in the body fade away. You feel more at ease, more relaxed in the body than perhaps you have ever felt in your entire life. When you come out of a nice meditation sitter, you feel the body is so easy, so nice, so good. And you understand that there is a different way that the body can be. One way of feeling this is like the body becomes very light, incredibly light. And this is why it sometimes feels like you're floating up in the air. It becomes like a tuft of cotton, right? It becomes this really bouncy, light thing. Often the body is heavy, but when your mind starts to become relaxed and at ease, the body too starts to feel very light. This is what I mean. It doesn't disappear completely. It's just that it's not a problem anymore. And when the body isn't a problem, it also tends to mean that the mind too is in a good space. Because the mind is what makes the body feel wrong in the first place. So you just stay with the body. Staying with the body just means that you're feeling the body as it is. It doesn't mean that you are thinking about the body, structure of the body, and all these kind of things. It just means you feel the body, you're experiencing it, and you allow it to relax with the right attitude and all these kind of things. That's really all it means. Yes, you can also do things like contemplating the structure of the body, understanding that it's subject to old age and all of these kind of things. You can do that, but that's something else. That's more like doing contemplation. That's a different thing. It's also good, and the purpose of those kind of contemplations is again to make the mind clear, to allow the mind to let go so that we can move forward in a meditation practice. Is there a good way to meditate at work? A short 5 to 10 minute break? Sure, go for it. If that is fine, if you can kind of... sometimes these days, at work people want to squeeze more efficiency out of their workers, so they say, okay, everybody has to meditate to get more efficiency. So if you have a good employer and they have read some of the literature that is available now about mindfulness and things, they will probably say, good on you, go for it, meditate more, meditate 5 minutes, every few hours or whatever. They will actually support that. I think that's a very good idea. When you do that, you can also feel whether you are getting stressed or not, or you can feel that you're about to get stressed. Okay, don't want to go there. You just close your eyes and just relax a little bit, right? Take a few deep breaths. Whew, enough. I don't want to destroy my life because I have to, perform at work, anything like that. Work isn't that important. We tend to give it too much importance. I remember one of the wonderful things, that was actually one of the nuns at Amasara Monastery. She told me she was working in Malaysia, and she told me that she was working for Merck's, one of these drug companies, and she had some nice position. And one day she was fired. And she said, hooray, fired, free, now I can do whatever I want. I can just meditate, I can do retreats. And eventually she became a nun at the Masara Monastery here. Isn't that a wonderful way of thinking about things? If your employer fires you, hooray, free of that burden, wonderful. And that is such a different attitude to work than what most people have. So this is kind of because it means you understand priorities again. Your priorities are right. And then you don't worry too much if you get fired. You know, getting fired is quite common anyway, right? So why should we be so, why should we be surprised at that? We shouldn't really be surprised. It just means we haven't really understood the nature of things quite enough yet. Actually, that's one of the other things about being a monk. You don't really get fired, right? It's great. Imagine if Ajahn Brahm fired me. Whoa, that would be very interesting. Enough. Go back to Norway. Okay. I don't know how to do walking meditation. Can you please explain a few words on how to do this type of meditation? Okay, so I hope you are satisfied with my previous answer to that. Dear Ajahn, you are a very successful teacher. Please don't keep any doubts about your teaching. Okay. Is it possible to get a CD of this retreat? I don't think so. I don't think it has been recorded. Has it been recorded? Is it been recorded? Okay. Well, then it's possible. Yeah. Get it online. Okay. Okay, so I'm sure Bianca, at the end of the retreat, you will give all the information that's required. Yeah. Okay. Excellent. That's always nice to get some good feedback. Sometimes you think, should I teach or not teach it? And of course, if you get some good feedback, there's more reason to do that. So that's good. Or maybe it's bad, actually, when I think about it. Maybe that's... not sure. Good, bad, who knows? Okay, what was the sutta you read out? Where is it from? Many thanks for Anjali. So the sutta I read out, the one I read out this morning is found in the Anguttara Nikaya 10s. There's a few suttas at the beginning there which are all about this gradual, how meditation is to be experienced subjectively. So if you go to the Anguttara 10s, I hope, do you know the scriptures well? If you don't know them well, you may have problems. Anguttara Nikaya, one of the main scriptures of early Buddhism. It is divided into books, the ones, the twos, all the way up to the 11s. The book of tens, first two or three suttas, you find it there. The second sutta I was talking about today is called the Anapanasati Sutta, found in the Majjhima Nikaya, the middle-length discourses of the Buddha, Majjhima Nikaya number 118. So go to number 118 and you find that sutta there, the sutta on mindfulness of breathing. If you can't remember that, see me later on and I will give you the exact details. Non-self, I just can't grasp the concept. Layman's terms, please. Okay. I can't grasp the idea of non-self. Okay. okay, fair enough. I can't, I think that's fair comment. It's not easy to grasp. And it's a very profound teaching. It is the teaching that makes Buddhism stand apart from almost all other spiritual teachings or religious teachings in the world. Because no self also really means no God, right? No creator God. That's one of the things that it means. Because these are two aspects of the same thing. That there is no such thing as a permanent entity in the world. So very, quite hard to grasp. But what it basically means, that if you look inside of yourself, there is nothing there that is always stable, always, always present, that you can call the real you. And it is not scary. You may think that this is really, really scary, but actually it is the opposite. And it's just, again, it's about how we look at these things, how we perceive this thing, that is the most important thing here. So the way to perceive this is when you sit down and meditate, you become peaceful, right? When you become peaceful, there is less of a sense of self there. The sense of self expresses itself in verbalizing, in talking, in doing, in all these kind of things. The more peaceful you are, the less sense of self there is. How does it feel to be peaceful? It feels pretty good, right? So the sense of self, you can say it's a burden, it's a problem. It takes away from your happiness. And this is how you can start to understand that the sense of self actually is a major problem. The more peaceful you are, the less sense of self there is, the more happy you are. And you can extrapolate that, and you can start to see that, you know, if you take that into the future, wow, or take that much further, less sense of self, the more happiness there is, until eventually you give up all sense of self, and you are, whoa, so happy because of that. So don't worry about the sense of self. It's you know, it's something that you, again, it's about looking at it in the right way. As your meditation goes deeper, you start to understand what it means. You look back on the process, you start to see things disappearing as the process moves forward, and you start to understand that those things that have disappeared, obviously, they couldn't be a self. This is how you uncover this gradually. I'm going a little bit fast now because we have just quite a few questions left. I was hoping to get through them all, so see what happens. May I have a copy of Ajahn Brahmali's sequence from this morning? It started off with non-regret, etc. I would like to learn it. Thank you. Bonnie Bruce. Okay, even the even have the internet address here. I hope I can read it correctly. Who is Bonnie Bruce? Over there. Okay, great. Okay. I'll see if I can get one for you before you leave. Yeah. Excellent. I'm not sure if I can read your internet address. I might get it wrong, so I better give it to you beforehand. Thank you. Okay. Hello, Ajahn. Could you please talk about whether a loving kindness practice can support the first step of virtue on this weekend retreat? Yes, it can definitely support the first step of virtue, of course. And this is actually one of the reasons why I would recommend almost everybody to do some loving kindness meditation. Because it is a very powerful way of developing, you know, the kindness towards the people around you. If you feel a natural sense of friendliness, of kindness, even love, if you like, but of course, a kind of more like impersonal kind of love towards the people around you, it is very easy to be kind. So do that. Please, please do a metta meditation, as we call it in Pali. And the way to do that is to start off with an object, or start off with reminding yourself of all these good qualities in the people around you. When you see good qualities in people, it's relatively easy to have metta towards them. Right? You remember all the good people in this world. There's a lot of good people in this world. And visualize the northern direction from here. Wish all those people out there, all the people with... Remember what it means to be truly generous, right? It's a beautiful quality inside of you when you are really generous towards somebody else. And all these people out there who have the same kind of quality. These are people who deserve to be happy, people who deserve to have a good life. And it's quite easy to wish them, may you have a happy life. May you be happy. Relatively easy. It's not giving rise to a feeling of metta is something that many people have a problem with, but it's something that you can do with gradual practice. So please, that's a very good point. So please do that. Why aren't monks and possibly nuns allowed to store food? What exactly does the Buddha say about this? Thank you. It's a good question. Why aren't we allowed to store food? We are allowed to store some kinds of food. We can store very simple things like sugar and coffee and that sort of thing. So that's okay, but not really edible food. We can't really store that. In part, I think the idea is perhaps, it's hard to know exactly, the Buddha doesn't actually say, this is one of the few rules that was actually broken by an arahant, right? Even arahants can break rules. There was an arahant who was broke this originally, and the Buddha had to lay down the rule as a consequence of that. But I think part of this is the idea that we're supposed to have a relationship between the lay community and the monastic community. And if monks start to store food and we start not to go into the village to receive alms, that was the way it was done in those days, you break some of that relationship. And it may sound strange, but it is considered, in all Buddhist countries, it is considered a blessing to be able to offer something to the monastic community, right? It's considered something very good. And if you get into that frame of mind when you want to support the monastic community, you support Buddhism, you support this wonderful movement in the world that creates so much happiness and a reduction of suffering in people's life. Once you get into that state of mind, it becomes a very beautiful thing. So I think the Buddha wanted to encourage that. He wanted to encourage the mutual relationship between the lay community and the monastic community here. That relationship can be quite complicated. It's not a one-off that the lay community provide material support for the monastics and the monastic provide teachings. It's not always like that. Sometimes the lay people can provide teachings as well. It's a bit more complicated, but generally speaking, that is how it is. And it's actually a very beautiful thing. People think that, maybe monastics are taking advantage of the lay people, but please don't think like that. It's not really like that at all. It's a very beautiful, harmonious relationship that is going on there. And when it works, it creates happiness all around for everybody. That is really the purpose of this. So I think that may be the main reason, so that thing isn't split, so to speak, and destroy that possibility here. How to do walking meditation? Open eyes or closed eyes? Oh, not sure if I would recommend to close your eyes. Gee, that sounds dangerous. Please keep your eyes open, because otherwise we may have to have the first aid kit ready for you and rescue you maybe from some pit somewhere you fall down into the lake, drowning or whatever. Please keep your eyes open when you do walking meditation. You can have very profound experiences, as I was saying before, even with your eyes open. Dear Ajahn, why is it that my dreams are always so vivid when I stay at Jhana Grove? Okay, that is probably a good sign, because your mind is getting clearer, right? And you stay here, and because your mind is clearer, it means you remember the dreams better. It means that the dreams aren't as confused while they're happening. So I think that's probably a good sign that your dreams are vivid. Of course, if you go even further, the dreams start to disappear altogether. And when you wake up, if you have a lot of loving kindness, for example, you usually don't dream much at all. And what you find instead is that you wake up in the morning, you feel very energetic and very good about yourself. That is the best kind of night, when you just sleep very soundly, very well, peacefully, and you wake up in the morning energized and ready for the day. And the way to do that, said the Buddha, again, is to practice loving-kindness meditation. So please practice loving-kindness. Find a nice recording, somebody you trust who practices this. Listen to that guided meditation, and that will take you through. That is the easiest way to do metta meditation, at least initially, until you get the hang of it. Okay. Dear Ajahn, I did not know until this morning that recollection or thinking of past memories or incidents is a sin and brings bad karma. I'm not sure if I said quite that, but anyway. So I certainly didn't mean to say that, I think. Could you kindly elaborate on this? Also, if you can explain about anapanasati and vipassana, greatly appreciated. Thank you. Okay, so Thinking is in general not very much karma at all. Yes, if you indulge in very bad fantasies, it can be bad karma. If you indulge in very good fantasies, it can be very good karma, right? But generally speaking, just thoughts, random thoughts that come during the day that we have sometimes, they're not very strong karma at all. Of course, if there is a person that you always hate, right, in your mind, oh, I really hate this person, then of course that is not so good. So you try to overcome that. But generally speaking, it's not a major issue. But the purpose here is really to develop the mind in such a way that it supports our ability to be kind in the world. If you have a good mind state, it's easy to be kind, easy to be generous, easy to look upon people with a positive eyes, to give them the benefit of the doubt, right? This is what this really is all about. So very useful to change your mind state, because it reduces the chances that you will do stupid things. As long as we allow the negative thoughts, the bad thoughts to linger in the mind, it means eventually they will come out. Eventually they will manifest, right? In this life, okay, you are a Buddhist, you're doing all the right things. In next life, maybe you will be reborn in some dodgy place, right? You get reborn in this mafia family, and you still have all this anger inside of you, and the mafia says, okay, go and kill this person. And you say, yes, sir, and you go off and you do that because the anger is still there, right? But if you have reduced that anger and you have reduced all those defilements, even if you fall in with the wrong circumstances and you're conditioned in the wrong way, you have more resistance towards that because you have already built up your defenses. So all of this, developing your mind, is actually very, very important because you are building up your defenses for the future, your ability to withstand these things in the future and to continue that development as well. So important to do as much as you possibly can. Anapanasati and Vipassana. Maybe I will talk about that tomorrow. I will see if I can fit that into the talks tomorrow because it's a bit involved. And if I start that now, I don't think I have the energy left to talk about that. I'm just kind of mangle my words and say stupid things. I'd rather not do that. So I'll just put it aside for now. Please remind me if I forget about it tomorrow. Dear Ajahn, how do I stop my mind from talking to me here? Okay, are you sure it is the mind talking to you, or is it you doing the talking? Who is doing the talking here? This is the interesting thing here. We feel like we are passive victims of the talking mind, but are we really passive victims? Or is it perhaps that you want the mind to talk? And the reality is, the reason why the mind is talking is actually because you want it to talk. And this is the problem, and it also shows you the path to the solution. So why do you want it to talk? Because you think it is nice to talk, right? You think that watching the breath is boring. Don't want to watch the breath, I'd rather think about things. And that shows you the solution. The solution is then to value the breath more, value the meditation object more, make it more beautiful, have some sense of metta for it, and understand that all this thinking, what are you thinking about anyway? The purpose of meditation is not to think. Now you have the chance to be in the presence of some of the most powerful things that you can experience in this life. Take the opportunity. Now you are approaching the meaning of life. All that thinking, it's got nothing to do with the meaning of life. It's all mostly just nonsense anyway. So you have to redirect your mind, understand what really matters, what actually is important in the world. And then these things happen in the right way. So it is because you want to think. That's why you are thinking. And you have to want something else more. If you want something else more, the thinking will stop. That's really what it's all about. Okay. Okay. I'll do one more. There's actually more questions here than I had thought. I'll do one more. And then tomorrow, I promise, I will spend a bit of extra time. And we can do some of the questions then. When I am meditating, I always yawn and tears. My legs are numb. So you yawn and you have tears and your legs are numb. Okay, that's fine. That's okay. Don't worry about that. If your legs are numb, maybe you are sitting in the wrong posture. Could that be the reason? Maybe try sitting on a chair, right? Or do they go numb even on the chair perhaps? I don't know. Try to find a different position. Lying down meditation is great. I was always rather shocked when I heard that one of the greatest meditation masters, living meditation masters that I know about, he says lying down meditation is his favorite posture. Why? Because you're really relaxed, right? When you're really relaxed, one of two things happen. Either you fall asleep or you have enough mindfulness to be able to meditate. Right? So one of those two things will happen. So check it out. Try lying down meditation. Don't lie down perhaps on your bed, that's maybe a little bit too soft, but lie down on the carpet or something a bit firmer and see what happens. Sometimes that can be very nice to try that out, especially if your legs get numb or whatever. Yawn and tears, that's okay. If you want to cry or you have some tears, don't worry too much about that. If you want to yawn, no worries, keep, yawn away to your heart's desire. After a while, the yawning will stop, right? You can only yawn so much. You can't yawn continuously. After 10 minutes, you get pretty fed up with yawning. So you start to kind of, it stops by itself. So just allow the yawning to work itself out of your system. And then when the yawning has worked itself out, you will be fine afterwards. Okay, I think I have to stop there. Otherwise, I will become a victim of yawning myself. So that is great. There are still a few questions left. I hopefully tomorrow we will be able to look at this. Bianca, the morning's talk from... is from 10 to 10:30. What happens from 10:30 to 11?
I'm not sure.
Sorry? Is it? Okay.
Does anybody have the schedule here? No?
Okay.
Is it 9:30 here?
Yeah, 9:30. That's where I'll be recording. Hopefully you'll show up for
it. Let's just see, because... Okay, we'll find out tomorrow. It doesn't matter. We'll find out tomorrow what happens. I'll speak to Bianca and we can do it then. I'll just leave these questions up here and then we'll sort it all out tomorrow at some stage. So. Okay, so that's all for this evening. So have a nice night. Enjoy a nice rest. And as a nice rounding off of the evening, let's just pay homage to the Buddha Dhamma Sangha. Let's do the Arahang together. Okay?